I see nothing quite conclusive in the art of temporal government, but violence, duplicity, and frequent malversation. King rules or barons rule, the strong man strongly, the weak man by caprice. They have but one law, to seize the power and keep it, and the steadfast can manipulate the greed and lust of others. The feeble is devoured by his own. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast on the great books and the liberal arts. The quote I read is from T.S. Eliot's play Murder in the Cathedral. It's the story of the murder of St. Thomas à Becket. Becket was King Henry II's pal, who he appointed Chancellor and then Archbishop of Canterbury. As Chancellor, Becket was Henry's man, to do the king's will any way the king wanted it done, be that honestly or dishonestly. But when he became Archbishop, something changed. He realized that he now needed to be God's man, a decision that, given the outcomes, enraged Henry. Professor Kyle Washit discussed Eliot, Thomas, and what he called perfected courage at the 2018 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. Professor Washit is our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar.
Professor Washit, at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, you talked about three kinds of courage: civic courage in Aristotle, purifying courage in St. Anthony, and perfected courage, or perfecting courage, in T.S. Eliot. How does Eliot develop perfected courage in Murder in the Cathedral?
So this becomes, I think, Eliot's, in some way, central focus toward the end of his work as a poet. It's a focus for him in the question of Murder in the Cathedral, and it's the focus in his last great set of poems, The Four Quartets. And it's a focus for him, he wouldn't use the words perfected courage, right? That's the way, say, a Neoplatonist philosopher might describe it. But the question for T.S. Eliot is the problem of time, the problem of the passing of this world, the problem of the fragmentation of our experience. It's a problem he already raises in The Wasteland. Things are fragmented and spread out. And the question he has is, how do we get over that? How do we come to hold everything together in a way that is free from fragmentation, free from distraction, free from being spread out? This is the problem he opens with in the Four Quartets. The Four Quartets start initially from chunks of maybe overly cerebral verse that he had to pull out of Murder in the Cathedral because they didn't fit with the drama so much. He frames that in the case of the Murder in the Cathedral, seeing the central place for this question is the question of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is the book in the Bible about the sort of vanity of human existence, our fragmentation, our being stretched out and falling apart, and our inability to overcome death. So what Eliot wants to consider is not just how are you going to be virtuous and strong in this life, in the world of time, or even preparing to leave the next life, but what does that courage look like at the moment you break through the confines of earth, the vanity of existence? And he makes St. Thomas Becket the image of that, the image of the courage that stretches out through death and comes to stand before the face of God. And in this sense, he gives us two stages for Becket. Becket initially, in the first act of the play, goes through a series of temptations, modeled certainly on Christ's temptation, but also that look remarkably like the progression of Anthony, this progression of purifying courage, this courage that prepares you to face death. And he works through these confrontations with the demons, which come to him in the form of various and ultimately culminate in coming as like these animals in the way that they came, say, Anthony in the desert, coming to attack and tempt him. And he overcomes it. And at the end of that first act of the play, Becket declares, "Temptation will not come in this form again. I have gotten through that." Now the drama of the play, with Becket actually dying in Canterbury, is a drama where he is free from passion and action. It is a drama of a expression of eternal virtue in the language that Eliot's going to wrap around it, breaking into time and kind of transfiguring time in an image of the way that Eliot sees Christ's virtue. And that is so different for Eliot, like it's hard to describe that as the same kind of virtue in these other considerations we have. And yet it's an act clearly of courage, an act of overcoming something really terrible, but not because you're scared of death, not because you're purifying yourself from your own internal weaknesses, but because you're in fact sort of reconfiguring the cosmos, coming face to face with God. And that's a kind of epic moment. And that's the moment that Eliot's really interested in, and what we would call, following Plotinus, perfected courage.
Talk to us a little more about that. In the play, Thomas is accosted by four tempters. The first offers him pleasure, the second power and preferment, the third praise and adulation, and then the fourth tempts him with martyrdom and sainthood, which is interesting. Tell us about the temptations, particularly that last one.
So the first three, you know, are more clearly modeled in some ways on the traditional temptations one would face in terms of the life of Christian virtue. The temptation to a life of pleasure, which Beckett even says, like, look, I'm too old for that. This is not a compelling temptation for me. The next two deal with either a return to a kind of power as being a vassal to the king, or a return to the kind of power by overthrowing the king. And in either case, Beckett's going to reject those. Again, he's come to see that he's beyond the petty civic politics and defining his virtue and excellence in those terms. But the fourth one, Beckett expresses surprise. I was not expecting a fourth. And it's this one that is very much about tempting him to, as Beckett will say, the last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right thing for the wrong reason. So in fact, tempting him, so to speak, with martyrdom, but having him approach martyrdom as something that he does, something he does to achieve glory. And he precipitates that martyrdom by excommunicating the king, by doing all of these great things, and then he will be famous, and he will stand, and people will come and venerate his shrine, and even when they forget about the shrine at Canterbury, he will still be in heaven while his enemies are in hell. And so, do this, Thomas, for your own greatness. And Thomas rejects that with some significant struggle, right? It's the culmination of the first act. And what he has to get to is to the point where he realizes, as he'll say in the sermon that Eliot has him deliver on Christmas Day in the interlude, it is not something that he does. It is something he allows God to do in him. And that shift in the perspective on martyrdom, martyrdom is now not some glorious act of my own courage, but martyrdom is something that happens by God expressing eternity into time. It's something beyond human power, so to speak. And yet, in a way that even though it looks like something's happening to Thomas, it's beyond, as Eliot will say, beyond the question of action and passion. It's Thomas in somehow sharing in God's life. And that's the key for Eliot, the way we're going to break through. Because otherwise, you're going to have the accusation. Any martyr is a kind of person suffering from delusions of grandeur so great they're willing to do it even though they know they're going to die. And Eliot seems to say, yeah, that's right. If you think of martyrdom like that, you could have any number of people willing to endure death who aren't Christian martyrs. But when you rightly consider Christian martyrdom, what makes it amazing is it's God doing something in a way that transcends human action. And that's what Beckett realizes at the end of the first act and what he tries to explain in his sermon in Murder in the Cathedral.
Well, then, after King Henry's knights arrive, bringing death and everyone yelling, bar the doors, protect the archbishop, Thomas refuses to allow the doors to be barred, faces the four knights who have come to kill him, and, well, they kill him. Then they justify their actions. Tell us about the speeches that three of the knights make, and specifically the way this whole thing about Thomas did this to himself to be a big deal. It was really just a suicide. Don't blame us.
It's a really interesting thing that Eliot does in the context of the play. The knights don't give their defense in verse, and they do it directly addressing the audience, breaking that fourth wall of the theater. And I think it's Eliot's trying to say, no, this is fundamentally a question. In some ways, it's possible because what Thomas does in his martyrdom is this breaking of sort of the divides of time. So the knights are able to speak across the centuries, so to speak, to the audience and discuss the perennial meaning of Thomas's martyrdom. So the first knight defends himself saying, look, we did this in an entirely self-interested way, selfless way, right? We did this getting nothing for ourselves. We, in fact, are going to be punished. We are going to be judged by history. And in a certain way, this knight seems to be speaking of their own act of killing Thomas as a more selfless kind of martyrdom, purely altruistic motivation than Thomas's, that they're willing to, you know, endure condemnation and go down in history as pariahs for the sake of what they think is the good. And that sort of sets the stage. By the time we get to the last knight defending their actions, the knight saying, yes, and not only did we do this in an entirely selfless way, Becket himself did this in the exact opposite, as an entirely egomaniac-driven kind of thing, trying to get martyrdom accomplished. And so he is the one that is just, you know, guilty of suicide by cop, so to speak. He was utterly crazy, and he made us do this. And then lastly, he notes, and if you appreciate the fact that the church is now firmly kept in its place and doesn't have any, that it's, you know, rightly subordinate to the secular government, then you should appreciate what we did. We were the first actors, the first agents to create the modern arrangement of church and state. And so we were the martyrs, in one sense, of the modern period. And Thomas was just a delusion of grandeur from an ancient period. And that, I think, Eliot sees as the fundamental challenge of that St. Thomas Becket poses to us. You know, his fight with the king seems to be something that we ourselves can't even really appreciate in the modern society, right? That he was fighting over whether or not the king could prosecute his priests in criminal court. Certainly in our modern setting, it's very hard to appreciate why that would be a noble thing to defend when much of what our focus is by all goods, make sure that the clergy are answerable to civic authority for the crimes they've committed. So it's hard for us to understand the political context in which Becket makes sense. And Eliot seems to say, look, that's the wrong way to think of it. You've got to think of Becket as a martyr sharing in Christ's transformation of reality, sharing in the stepping into an eternal perspective. Because if we don't think about that, in the end, we're going to be inclined to agree with the three knights. Becket's martyrdom becomes unintelligible to us.
And thus, April is the cruelest month.
Exactly. And then if we concede that, then in fact, that's what's going to get us on the fast track to the world of the wasteland, when we're going to be leaving Canterbury and all of the rest. We're just entering pure secular society. We've got to figure out some other way to judge and evaluate this, and that's a new form of virtue, this eternal virtue.
As the killers advanced, Thomas's priests urged him to run. Thomas replied, "Peace, be quiet. Remember where you are and what is happening. No life here is sought for but mine, and I am not in danger, only near death." If you haven't yet tackled the work of T.S. Eliot, let me commend Murder in the Cathedral to you. It's accessible and presents a mature development of perfected courage, the kind of courage we in our era need very badly. This summer, our podcasts have been lectures and interviews from the 2018 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. And while we're still deciding on a topic, The dates for the 2019 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought are set. It will be held June 9th through the 14th, 2019, here in Lander, Wyoming. So save the dates, plan to join us, and perhaps plan a Wyoming vacation along with it. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.